Welcome to Sidactic. I am Dr. O'Leary, and today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. I am a fourth-year psychiatry resident in the National Capital Region, and this is a podcast about psychiatry and neuroscience. I make this podcast myself, in my office, while my wife, kids, and dog are not being too loud in the background. My staff consists of me, myself, and I. And while we often argue with each other, we don't have an editorial staff or fact checkers to make sure that we don't make obvious or avoidable mistakes. I also need to inform you that all the opinions here are my own and do not necessarily represent the views of my residency, the Defense Health Agency, the U.S. Army, or anyone else. Just me. Today, I'm continuing an intermittent series I've called In a Word. Past episodes have explored words like akathisia, dissociation, perseveration, and even the difference between impulsive and compulsive. Today, I'm going to explore confabulation. I first encountered what appeared to be obvious confabulation from a patient with Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. He woke up in the hospital every day with a new explanation for how he had arrived. For those who don't know, Wernicke-Korsakoff is a condition that happens when the mammillary bodies in the brain are damaged due to a thiamine deficiency that is most often caused by long-term heavy alcohol use. The mammillary bodies are slowly becoming better understood, but for a long time we have known that damaging them causes some degree of anterograde amnesia, which is a deficit in making new memories. Damage to the mammillary bodies also impairs recall of already formed memories. Interestingly, patients often don't act as if they cannot remember details. They just appear to freely make them up as they go. And when they make up these details, that is confabulation. There is a circuit in the brain called the Papez circuit. The hippocampus, which is well known for its role in memory, has a friend in the medial temporal lobe called the entorhinal cortex, which itself is also a major memory hub. So the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex play a game of telephone where they kind of talk back and forth to each other. And then the hippocampus sends messages to the mammillary bodies that I just mentioned. And these lines travel through a loop around the fornix. The mammillary bodies then call the anterior thalamus, who then calls up the cingulate cortex. The cingulate completes the loop by calling up the entorhinal cortex, who is then talking with the hippocampus. Like any game of one-way telephone, if one of the players messes things up, what comes out the other end is something unexpected. This loop is thought to play a major role in both spatial and episodic memories. The mammillary bodies also appear to help out coordinating movements along with the cerebellum, and also in learning reward-seeking behaviors and recalling kind of the salient details of events and objects in the environment. Confabulation has been described as, quote, false memory, or, quote, an honest lie. Patients appear to just fill in the blanks of their memory with whatever seems reasonable at the time. There's no intent to deceive. I don't think it would be fair to merely call all false memories confabulations. One could make them equivalent. But I feel like there's something special about confabulations. One thing is that they're not really memories. At least, not necessarily memories. What I mean is that confabulated facts don't always stick around either. After they say them, they often fade away pretty quick. Someone with bilateral damage to their mammillary bodies will also likely have anterograde amnesia, so they won't be making memories about the confabulated story they just told. It may be that it was an easy story for them to tell, so they might end up telling it again, but not because they remember that they told it before. Instead, when I use the term confabulation, I think of it as a fragile brain state that's the result of an attempt to make meaning out of current circumstances or to fill holes in our actually remembered experiences. Our memories are not connections with some ethereal unconscious outside of our bodies. They're merely recreated brain states that help us to learn, and at times even to explore our past so that we can learn later something we didn't learn at the time. When the memory recreation mechanism malfunctions, but is still sending signals that a memory has been retrieved, then our past is no longer static. It creates itself. Apparently, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex has the capacity to, I guess you could say, raise doubt about the truthiness of our memories, and it may be one of the parts of our brain regions that allow us to experience uncertainty. So if the ventromedial prefrontal cortex is damaged, then we might lose a vital kind of double-checking mechanism. Our default mode network is particularly active when we're engaged in self-referential thought or memory retrieval. So it makes sense that this ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is part of the default mode network, would play a role in distinguishing between what is fact and what is fantasy. I mean, something has to. Besides the frequently ethereal nature of confabulated memories, they might also lack some of the emotionally salient features that real memories have, or that false implanted memories can have, which is different than a confabulated memory. Especially when the mammillary bodies are damaged, these kind of invented memories are often experienced as just matters of fact and not really associated with memories of emotions or with the same kind of force that our more truthy autobiographical memories have. They're like movies in the brain, or movies that the brain is watching and then suddenly just adopted as its own story. False memories are different, or an implanted false memories especially, partly because they're just far more personal. In my last episode, I discussed a forensic psychiatry case regarding how the courts have, through time, kind of changed their opinions about the culpability of adolescents and children for their crimes. Other cases I discovered during my foray into forensics included cases of adults or of parents who were accused of rape, sexual assault, or abuse by children or by students because a therapist had insisted that their patient's current psychiatric symptoms must have been due to some past trauma. And then they suggested the culprits, who of course happened to be important people in their patient's lives. After some time with these repressed memory recovering therapists, the patients appeared to find lost memories hidden in their unconscious or in their subconscious mind. Many lives were irreparably altered. That's a great word, irreparably altered. When allegations of the recovered memories were brought to authorities and these people were prosecuted, and some of them found guilty. Studies since have confirmed over and over and over again that our memories are not like static things that just sit there. They are malleable. They are highly suggestible. And we often fill in the blanks without meaning to. Studies of witnesses of crimes, like for example, have shown that if you use targeted questioning, you can make a witness become certain of a memory of something that could not possibly even have occurred. Just Google memory suggestibility and you'll recover more examples than you could possibly read of this kind of false memory phenomenon. This is a pressing problem now with the advent of like the information superhighway, social media, and we can easily suggest to people explanations for events that either that person experienced or they experienced by reading about and suddenly have memories about these things. I mean, these suggestions then create what appear to be like evidential memories, and they're strongly associated with whatever that person's emotional state was at the moment that that explanation was suggested to them. But let me get back to confabulation. I'm defining confabulation not merely as a false memory or kind of a delusional memory or even as a suggested memory, but instead kind of as an immediate need to fill in the blanks in the brain without that kind of salience that real or intentionally fabricated memories have. I think that it's important to be precise about language and not let our words have broad meanings, because as psychiatrists, I mean, we should always be trying to get to a closer explanatory model, models that have more predictive power. I mean, if we use a word like confabulation for every single kind of false memory or appearing to be false memory, then we're not being precise about the mechanism by which that false memory was made. I mean, even if we don't know for certain the neurological difference between an implanted or suggested memory and one that was invented in the spur of the moment to kind of help a person whose brain is not functioning normally just kind of make up some kind of temporal sense of continuity, we can still know that these phenomena are likely different things. Or at least they're different things until proven otherwise. I think it's of primary importance to distinguish between the workings of a pathological brain and a normal brain that has been manipulated by the kinds of experience that could influence any normally functioning suggestible brain. Now, there are many ways that our memory breaks down under very normal circumstances. People often remember things out of order or propose mistaken causality, such as when someone suggests that they made a decision because of information that, in fact, they actually found out about after the decision had already been made. Memories may place people at scenes where they were not, or kind of combine two separate events, especially events that have similar characteristics, like two arguments that happened during the same family event when they were, in fact, in different events. People may have semantic recall problems too when they're, like, for example, trying to say Ronald Reagan when they actually meant Richard Nixon. Now, I would not call these things confabulation because I want to preserve the word confabulation for more pathological or at least impromptu explanatory memory inventions that are likely not to be permanently recalled later because they're not really coherent memories. And they're not really associated with like other salient features that most memories have, such as emotions or particularly meaningful settings. I also would not call false memories or confabulations delusions, even if a patient insists that it's true. Now, I have not yet fully dealt with the word delusion, in large part because I'm still struggling with it, but I am convinced that a delusion is not merely a fixed, demonstrably false belief. I mean, if that were the case, then suggested and implanted memories would also be delusions. But I am sure that delusions, if we're trying to be more precise here, are not part of the same pathological mechanism as false memories that were implanted or confabulations. I want this kind of precision because the most important thing is the pathophysiology and the mechanism of whatever phenomenon we're talking about here. The pathophysiology determines things like the treatment and the prognosis. So trying to focus my words in a way that more clearly and quickly communicates very specific information is something that I feel like I should prioritize. I want to thank everybody out there for tolerating my soapbox today. I hope that even if you think I am wrong, that I've helped you consider confabulation in a way that you might not have considered it otherwise. If you want to leave me feedback, you can go to psydactic.com and there is a form there you can fill out. In the meantime, take care of yourself. I am Dr. O'Leary. This has been an episode of Psydactic.